Hello and welcome to the Food Principles module on the specific carbohydrate diet and the gut and psychology syndrome diet. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo and I'm excited to be presenting this information to you and to share with you some insights onto how these diets might fit into a plan, how you might modify these diets to better fit your particular client, and what the downsides and the upsides are of using these diets. So we're going to start with a little bit of history. But before we do, I want you to make sure that you're aware that anything I share with you and that you share with your clients in turn is not intended as medical advice. Just be careful in the languaging you use. You're helping people to educate themselves onto specific actions they can take to keep themselves in this balanced situation and help restore their own inner healing power. And that's really what we do. We're facilitators of a person's inner healing. We help them to identify and then carry out the different activities and foods, etc., that they need to be able to access their inner healing capacity. We are in no way taking liability for their medical situation, and we want to make sure that they're in concert with their own medical practitioner if they're on any medications or have a diagnosed disease. But we have such power in what we do, and the power of food to just unleash the body's natural healing power is so phenomenal that I am in awe of it and have a high respect for it every day of my life. So we're going to talk about these gut and psychology diet and the GAPS diet and the SCD diet, specific carbohydrate. These diets are carb restrictive diets, but not necessarily low carb diets. So I want to just share with you the distinction between them. If you have a low carb diet, it can also be carb restrictive. Things like the Atkins diet, the ketogenic diet, the autoimmune paleo diet. But carb restrictive diets are not necessarily low carb. They just may eliminate certain types of carbohydrates for various reasons. So examples of those are SCD, GAPS, FODMAPs, paleo, and primal hunter-gatherer type diets. So they're not necessarily low carb, but they do restrict certain types of carbs from the people that are eating them. So let's talk about low carbohydrate diets. Low carbohydrate diets we'll go into more detail on in another presentation. But basically with a low carbohydrate, we're restricting the net carbs, the total amount of carbs taken in minus the total grams of fiber. And a lot of times people will mistake a food as a high carb food because it shows on the label, oh wow, this has X number of grams of carbs and that's a high carb. But the fiber doesn't count because the fiber doesn't get absorbed and broken down into glucose. It actually just facilitates the movement. So we take the total number of grams of carbs minus the total number of grams of fiber, and that's what we get as net carbs. Carbs are restricted on these low carb diets to a certain number of grams or a certain percentage of the total calories. And when we look at paleo diets and ketogenic diets and other lower carb, well, paleo isn't really a low carb, but a ketogenic diets and some of the lower carb diets, we're going to look at like, what does that really mean? And where do those grams lie? And you're going to be surprised to learn that there's no absolute, just like everything else we've been talking about. There's no absolute that works for everybody. It's really a matter of helping each individual person determine what works for them. Low-carb diets are very helpful in controlling blood sugar. We get into the point of people burning ketones, even if they're not in a ketogenic, full-blown ketogenic diet, but a low-glycemic diet is very helpful in blood sugar control. They can also reduce inflammation and edema, and they're really super helpful for yeast, fungal, and bacterial overgrowth in the gut because the carbs actually feed these critters and helps them to overtake the normal population. So some of the diets consider the food sources of carbs and fiber. Others don't. Some just go, okay, low carb, like the Atkins diet. It's low carb, but it uses a lot of processed foods. And then some of them, like a standard ketogenic diet, would use a lot of meat and animal fats and dairy. and that creates an acidic environment in the body. So they're not being discriminatory about the quality of the food. They're just following it. So be careful when somebody says to you, oh, I've been following a ketogenic diet or a paleo diet or an Atkins diet, to really quiz them about what they're eating, because there can be good versions and not so good versions. And we're going to find that today in this presentation on the SCD and GAPS diets as well, that you can modify them slightly to actually take out some of the undesirable foods. Because the problem with most of these specialized diets is they focus on one constituent. They'll focus on carbs. So it doesn't matter what the quality of the carb is, as long as it's below a certain number of grams. We see that in the diabetic exchange diets that dietitians use. Oh, well, you can have X number of carbs. And so it doesn't matter if it's sugar, white rice, M&Ms, as long as you stay below the certain amount. We're more concerned with the quality of the food. And then in situations where certain food constituents need to be reduced or minimized, then we want that within the guidelines of a healthy overall whole foods diet. So this is a review from our macronutrients module. There's four types of carbohydrates. We have monosaccharides, disaccharides, oligosaccharides, and polysaccharides. And they all come down to how many glucose rings do they have? And they could be glucose or fructose, but how many of the monosaccharides? So monosaccharides is just one little sugar molecule. And basically, they're relatively easy to be absorbed by the body, sometimes too easy, and they can cause the blood sugar to go sky high. Disaccharides must be broken down into monosaccharides for absorption. And there are things like sucrose, lactose, and fructose are disaccharides. Oligosaccharides are shorter than polysaccharides, but not as short as disaccharides. So anywhere from like 3 to 10, 3 to 12 different sugars that are strung together. But oligosaccharides are only partially digestible by humans. The bonds between them are very difficult for us humans to break down, but they're really good fuel for intestinal microflora. Mostly they feed the good guys, but in some cases, in certain organisms, they can feed the bad guys as well. So then polysaccharides are like the starches and the really long chains with many, many, many mono and disaccharides together. So just to review, the three monosaccharides are glucose, fructose, and galactose. Galactose is the one that's broken down from lactose, so it's found in milk products. Glucose is found in just about everything, and fructose as well. So let's look at disaccharides. The common disaccharides are sucrose, lactose, and maltose. Sucrose is a glucose with a fructose. Lactose is galactose with a glucose, and maltose is two glucoses. And then oligosaccharides, you go fructooligosaccharides, inulin is one of them. There's a lot of different ones that we see, amylose, amylopectin, and they're basically chained together of three or more, but no more than 10 or 12. And then polysaccharides, things like cellulose, starch, glycogen, and chitlin. So polysaccharide means many, right? Obviously, chains of monosaccharides and disaccharides all joined together. And like I said, grains contain cellulose and glycogen. Starches, like as in potatoes, inulin breaks down into, I guess, oligosaccharides. And then mucilaginous fibers, like in flax seeds, aloes, seaweed. There's pectin, there's dextrin, and there's specific enzymes that are needed to break them down, right? Amylase, remember that? So what's a simple versus a complex? I know this is a review, but I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page before we go too far with this. So the simple carbohydrates are things that contain monosaccharides and disaccharides. So glucose, fructose, galactose, maltose, lactose, and sucrose. And we oftentimes in our world where we like to take really complex long molecules and break them down, we take those and break them down into the simple. So polysaccharides would be the starches, fibers, and glycogen. Fibers don't get absorbed, they just go through, like cellulose glycogen is our stored form of glucose. So we store it as this big starch molecule, and it gets put into the muscles and into the liver. And then, of course, there's the starches, like the things in our grains and legumes and potatoes and sweet potatoes, etc. Okay, so those are complex. The simple ones are simple. Usually we take like a whole wheat bread and we break it down, even though it's a starch. We call it more of a simple because it breaks down when you do the processing to take away the fiber and the rest of the good stuff. So now we're on the same page. So let's look at the SCD and GAPS diets, like the theory behind them. The theory behind them is they help us to change the gut bacteria and microbiome because they don't provide the fuel for those guys. So they have an intro diet. Both of them have an intro period, anywhere from 3 days to 7 days, where they're basically seeking to starve the bacteria. And we'll look at what that intro diet looks like. So that can reduce the bacterial overgrowth symptoms quickly. Another way to do an intro type diet or to starve bacteria and reduce bacterial overgrowth and symptoms quickly is by fasting. But it's not real popular to fast, and most people just cringe at the thought of fasting. But it does break the cycle of feeding bacterial overgrowth. It's one thing to cut things down and do a low carbohydrate or a specific carbohydrate, but at the beginning, if you want to just like really starve these guys out, this intro diet for these both are good, or fasting can be done as well. So basically, their goal in these diets is to remove the foods that cause damage to the gut, to encourage the gut healing and the rebalancing of the microbes. So basically what they're doing is they're removing all the di and polysaccharides, because these guys can feed bacteria if the proper enzymes aren't present for absorption. And that's the key phrase. If the proper enzymes are not present for absorption. So typically we should have the enzymes to break this stuff down. But if we don't, then these di and polysaccharides feed the bacteria. The theory is that monosaccharides are okay because they don't require any breakdown and they're going to get put into the bloodstream pretty quickly and absorbed into the bloodstream because they're simple. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, because I think that a lot of people do get candida overgrowth problems and all from eating those simple carbohydrates. And so another diet called the FODMAPs diet will actually eliminate all of that, the monos as well. But the theory is that it can relieve dysbiosis, right? Bad life in the gut, and IBS, which can result from dysbiosis, decrease inflammation and pain, help with diarrhea and constipation, and decrease gas and bloating. So that's the theory. Let's see how well it plays out and what the practicalities of it are. So the specific carbohydrate diet was originally designed by a doctor named Sidney Valentine Haas. Now, it's often attributed to Elaine Gottschall because she started promoting it in 1987 and wrote a book called Breaking the Vicious Cycle. But Dr. Haas was using it to treat chronic inflammatory gut when there wasn't any other way to treat chronic inflammatory gut, that medicine would just put people on steroids. Elaine Gottschall used the diet to heal her child of ulcerative colitis, and that's when she wrote the book Breaking the Vicious Cycle, Intestinal Health Through Diet. It was made popular in the online world in 2014 on its website called SCD Lifestyle website. This was Jordan Reisner and Steve Wright, and they are just two lay people who were helped by this diet from, you know, overcoming severe gut stuff and diarrhea and all this. They loved it, and they decided that they would start to teach other people about it and bring it online. Okay. So FODMAPs weren't known about when the SCD creation began. Well, back with Sidney Valentine, he didn't talk about FODMAPs, which is the fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. So they didn't know that all of those things, although some of these things, the di and the polysaccharides, are actually considered something to be aware of and get out of with SCD, with specific carbohydrate. So we didn't know about FODMAPs, and now a lot more protocols are using a combination of FODMAP and SCD type approaches. So let's just kind of look at what these things are and how they work. So the specific carbohydrate, that's the book, Breaking the Vicious Cycle. The specific carbohydrates that are consumed are all the monosaccharides. So that would be glucose, fructose, and galactose. The monosaccharides are considered to be easy to absorb and thus are allowed. So the idea is that they're not going to sit there in the gut while the enzymes are trying to break them down and then become fuel for the gut bugs. In reality, we find that the monosaccharides can be problematic for many people as well. So disaccharides, two saccharide molecules, and polysaccharides require extra digestive steps to break the chemical bonds to monosaccharides. These aren't allowed. Some oligosaccharides are, but as we learned as this evolved and the FODMAPs became popular, is that the oligosaccharides can be problematic for a lot of folks if they've got some dysbiosis going on, which most of the people that are considered for these programs do. And so some of the oligosaccharides actually, instead of just feeding our good guys, they will actually feed some of the bad guys. So the premise: complex carbohydrates, not easily digested, feed harmful bacteria, and they produce byproducts that inflame the intestinal wall. So SCD, like I said before, is not a carbohydrate restrictive. It's a carbohydrate restrictive, so it's specific carbs, but not a low-carb diet. So these are some of the foods that are allowed on the specific carbohydrate diet. Most cheeses are allowed, most vegetables, most fruits, some alcohol, most nuts and seeds, and most meats. Avoiding is all grains, potatoes, yams, parsnips, bean sprouts, cotton seeds, seaweed, and soy, and most sugars. And I'm not really sure I understand the seaweed part, except, oh, I guess it's the mucilaginous, and those mucilaginous fibers are considered to be problematic. Here's the thing, though. I would agree with the grains and the potatoes and the yams and the parsnips could be problematic here, but they're allowing cheese. And cheese, well, because it's cheese, it still doesn't make so much sense because, well, I guess the idea is that the cheeses have galactose because it's been fermented, but you're not allowed to have other dairy products which still have the lactose, which is a disaccharide. However, there's a lot of problems in cheeses, especially if they're not organic, and there's no distinctions made here between them. Vegetables, fruits, some alcohol, which is kind of weird. There's certain types of fermented, not beer and not wine, I believe it's some of the hard liquors that are allowed. And again, I have some exception to that because alcohol destroys brain cells. Alcohol puts a stress on the liver. Most nuts and seeds are okay, most meats, but again, no distinction made between organic meat and commercial meat. Okay. So the pros and the cons. Well, the pros are it eliminates all the gluten. It eliminates the grains, and then that makes all the processed foods and breads be eliminated. So it really helps to get rid of a lot of the processed foods. And it eliminates most sugars. So sucrose, which is a disaccharide, which is in most products, it does eliminate. But fructose, it doesn't, because it's a monosaccharide. It allows most nuts and seeds, and that's pretty good. It allows most non-starchy vegetables and most fruits. So it can be balanced if people use it that way. But the cons is it still allows dairy products. It allows alcohol. It allows artificial sweeteners and preservatives. It eliminates many nutritious vegetables, which may or may not be harmful for a person. And certainly I can see at the beginning of a diet that you do a severe elimination and then add it back in. It eliminates sea vegetables because of the mucilaginous, and some people may have a problem and some people don't. It also eliminates some of the really healthy, healing mucilaginous foods that we use a lot, like slippery elm, chia, and flax. But know that if you have a person that you're working with, that they eat these foods, which we think are healthy and healing, and they have problems, they get bloated, they get gassy, their gut issues get worse, then you know that this might be a place for doing a modified specific carbohydrate diet. It allows canned foods, like, you know, canned foods aren't the best, right? So canned foods, it allows stearates, like in magnesium stearates and things like that. And it even allows some dried fruits and high glycemic fruits, which might be problematic for people if they have blood sugar issues. So always when you're looking at evaluating different diets, you want to look at specifically what are the good things, what are the bad things, and try to make a diet that can be the best of both worlds. So examples. So what's allowed on an SED GAPS diet? Meat, unprocessed meat. So not like, you know, the salami and pastrami and hot dogs and things like that. But they don't make a distinction of organic. And you know that if we're having people that are eating meat, we want to make sure that we make the quality distinction as well. Fish, eggs, nuts, and some dairy, specifically cheeses. So the monosaccharides that are allowed that could be problematic for people, especially with a candida overgrowth or a problem with blood sugar, honey, fruits and fruit juices that are not from concentrate, non-starchy vegetables, and most spices. So good, great. Non-starchy vegetables, great. Spices are great. Fresh fruits, you know, for the most part, unless somebody's severely insulin resistant, which would have to avoid fruit for a while. But fruit juices are too concentrated in sugar, in my opinion, to be a good thing. So keeping all these things in mind as we go through this. And oligosaccharides only allows certain legumes. Well, they allow peanuts, but peanuts are fraught with aflatoxin and are high in arachidonic acid, which is inflammatory. They do allow white, navy, lima, kidney, and black beans. So if you're working with somebody who has a blood sugar issue, I'd be testing those because a lot of these beans actually cause people to have gas. So you want to just, you know, bear it out. And lentils and split peas are allowed as well. So they don't eliminate very many of the legumes. So the foods they want people to avoid: grains, corn, starches and tubers, potatoes, soy products, sugar except for honey, cornstarch, arrowroot, tapioca, agar-agar, carrageenan, pectin, chocolate and carob. So chocolate can actually aggravate these critters, baking powder and canned fruits or vegetables. Okay, so these are the things to be avoided that contain di- and polysaccharides. So the intro diet. So they usually start people with a couple of days, up to 5 days, of this very specific intro diet, which is described in Elaine Gottschall's Breaking the Vicious Cycle book. Promotes die-off of the bacterial overgrowth. 1 to 2 days may not be enough to completely do that. If it's severe, 5 days is what they recommend. But during this process, they use dry curd cottage cheese and homemade yogurt. Okay, so you have somebody who has some casein sensitivity or whey sensitivity, and you're having them do this diet where they're eating these cheese and yogurt and eggs and then pressed apple cider or grape juice, not going to work for everybody. So really don't just jump in with this food religion and say, oh, yeah, let's try this GAPS diet. Let's look at a modified version of it. They use gelatin, chicken soup, broiled meat, and fish, and there's no vegetable matter in there, with the idea that the vegetables could cause problems. The vegetables contain polysaccharides, disaccharides, etc. And then once the person, this is for somebody in a really severe case with the diarrhea and cramping, once that subsides, they allow cooked fruit, ripe bananas, and cooked veggies, okay? So just use it with a grain of salt and modify it for the individual person. And keep in mind, quality is super important. So when would you want to use SCD? Well, in cases of SIBO, because some of the bacteria, as you know, that should be in the large intestine, have started to overgrow in the small intestine, and they feed on carbohydrates. Okay, but they may also feed on mono, and they may also feed on oligos, as the FODMAP diet, which is a later iteration of these, has pointed out. So when a person has insufficient migrating motor complex activity or carbohydrate digesting enzymes to control bacterial overgrowth are limited, then this is a good application, perhaps. The Neves theory removes the bacterial antigens that cause hyperstimulation of the immune system in inflammatory bowel disease and other autoimmune diseases, and in kids with autism. 71% improve on SCD, and I bet if the rest of them could improve if they actually paid attention to some of the other quality type things that we've been talking about. There were two studies that found people with autism to be lacking in enzymes for carbohydrate digestion and absorption, which could explain why the SCD diet works so well for them. The microbiota of children with autism were found to have additional growth substances for bacteria. Like they're feeding the bad gut bacteria, as well as less in the way of fructose and glucose transporters. So no fructose or glucose can present issues, okay? So the bottom line is that kids with autism are found to have differences in their microflora, differences in their enzymes in their gut that will help make them more susceptible, and they tend to do well. And you've seen it, I'm sure. You know, you take somebody and you put them on a gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free diet, and tremendous things happen. Well, you know, this is not dairy-free, but just the sugar-free and the gluten-free and the starch-free on top of it can be helpful. One of the distinctions, too, to make is that some people who we think might be gluten intolerant may actually be starch intolerant. So they don't necessarily get better when you remove the gluten until you remove all the starches. So let's take a brief overview of or reminder of SIBO, what it is, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. SIBO people do well on a FODMAP diet for a temporary period of time, usually a month, at most 2 months, where we remove not just the dye and polysaccharides, but we remove all the fermentables, the oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And polyols are sugar alcohols. Now, you hear of people a lot who have sorbitol or xylitol, and they get diarrhea and IBS symptoms from it. And there's another sugar alcohol called erythritol. This diet doesn't make a distinction, but a lot of people don't have a problem with erythritol because of the way it's absorbed in a different part of the intestine. So somebody who's on a diet like this might be able to get away with a little bit of erythritol once you got them stabilized. So at the time the SCD diet had been coming out, FODMAPs hadn't been researched as a problem. So fructose malabsorption wasn't really recognized. So it may be necessary to start SIBO clients with low FODMAPs in the beginning stages and then move to SCD, or combine them. And I'll share with you how I've combined the two to create some food plans that can work for a lot of folks. So the pros and the cons, okay? It eliminates gluten, eliminates processed grain and processed foods and breads, eliminates most of the sugars, allows for nuts and seeds, allows for non-starchy vegetables, and allows most fruits. The cons are the dairy products, which I believe can be problematic for a lot of folks, alcohol, which can be problematic for lots of folks. They don't make a distinction and allow artificial sweeteners and preservatives. They eliminate many vegetables which might otherwise be nutritious. They eliminate sea vegetables. And when I say this, I'm saying for long-term use, this may not be the best approach. Therapeutically, we can have people eat cardboard if we need to, right, to get them to feel better. But some people stay on these diets for long-term, and the long-term con is that a lot of the really good vegetables are eliminated. So I think those, and the sea vegetables. So it's a matter of really looking and saying, okay, how long is this going to be therapeutically beneficial? How can I modify it so it's therapeutically beneficial without including foods that are undesirable? And then how do I modify this, and how long does the person need to be on it? So some people just go on these diets for years and years and years at a time. The mucilaginous foods are so healing to the digestive tract that they're eliminated, and you have to determine, do they have to be? So maybe eliminate those for a little bit of time, but then try them back again, because they can be so healing for the gut and, you know, filled with the omega-3s and all that. The canned foods, the stearates, and some dried foods and high glycemic foods are also a con of the diet in terms of it being overall good long-term healthy diet to follow. Not disputing that it's not a good therapeutic diet and that it can also be improved with some attention to the health factors, the overall health factors. So compliance factors, it's not so easy to comply 100%, but according to Eileen Gottschild, it must be done with 100% compliance for to be effective for healing. It means avoiding all the polysaccharides and all the disaccharides for an extended, a month or two. As the patient heals, then they can introduce non-SCD foods. But if they have difficulty tolerating the FODMAPs, the monosaccharides and the polyols as well as the oligosaccharides, then you can make modifications to the SCD diet so that it eliminates all of it. Okay, so kids in SCD. There's a website called www.pecanbread.com, which has resources that you can share with parents who are dealing with their kids, or when you're dealing with kids as clients as well. Sometimes parents come to us and just ask us, how can we help their kids, and ask for advice. And other times they actually bring their kids in and we're working with the kids. But there's compliance issues and there's other things that make it difficult. And this website shows you 5 stages to slowly introduce difficult to digest foods. And it just gives you a bunch of stuff that you can help with. It talks about kids with autism, which is why it was developed. They use fruit cooked in the early stages rather than raw. They peel and deseed vegetables. So there's a lot of ways to help. And this approach will help you with the kids portion of it. So let's move to the gut and psychology syndrome diet, and we'll be looking at how it differs from the SCD. On the surface, it seems very similar, but there are a few distinctions. It's derived from from SCD by Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride. She wrote the book called Gut and Psychology Syndrome, and she's actually a psychologist. And she was working with a lot of people suffering from neurologic conditions that resulted, she made the connection to the imbalanced gut flora, so that gut-brain connection. So there's 3 parts of it. There's diet, there's supplementation, and detox. The SCD doesn't talk about detox, and it doesn't really talk much about supplementation. But the GAPS diet will actually take all those things into play. So what does she do? Well, the intro diet on GAPS is much longer than the intro diet on the SCD. It's 3 to 6 weeks. They start with juices and broths. Hopefully they're starting with vegetable juices. But the idea is to really heal and soothe the gut. They do a lot of bone broths and things like that. That she also stresses probiotic foods, whereas on this SCD diet, the probiotic foods are not stressed or emphasized, at least in any of the earlier stages. So she stresses the probiotic foods. She adds supplements. One is probiotics. So if people can't take the probiotic foods because of a histamine reaction, probiotics are a good alternative. Also, she focuses on essential fatty acids and vitamin A, which are really good things to be focusing on because those really help to heal the lining of the gut, as well as digestive enzymes to focus on helping the person to digest better, and then supplementing for vitamin and mineral deficiencies. So that's really good. She also talks about detox, like reducing the toxic load, doing some gentle cleansing using juices, cleansing foods, probiotic, coffee enemas, oil pulling, Epsom salts, clay, and seaweed baths. So it's kind of a modification to the SCD diet that actually enhances its effectiveness in a lot of folks. So the first stage, they're using meat stock, not bone broth. So it's actually meat stock with veggies eaten throughout the day. So they're not eliminating veggies in the first few days like they are on the SCD. So that's good. But the problem is some of the glycoproteins from bone breakdown can feed SIBO. So a lot of people who are doing bone broth diets are getting a lot of these glycoproteins that can feed the organisms that are displaced in the small intestine instead of the large. So that's why they're supposed to use this meat stock, not the bone broth. So in the broth, they put vegetables, right? Boiled onions, carrots, broccoli, leeks, cauliflower, zucchini, and winter squash with a 1 to 2 tablespoons of garlic, and they work up to a few teaspoons of sauerkraut juice per bowl. So actually taking the juice from the sauerkraut, and that's something that can be very tasty and very effective, is the juice from the sauerkraut. And they're working that up so that they're not stimulating, especially if there's an overgrowth of SIBO or histamine intolerance, to be careful with that. So it's a much better approach, I believe, from the start, because it's focusing on these broths and a lot of veggies. The stages, okay, so the first few weeks, there's no fruit and no flour. So it is a much lower glycemic diet in those first phases. The vegetable variety is just slowly increased. We don't just dump in and say, oh, let's make this vegetable broth using these 12 vegetables. It's slowly increased. And the methods of food preparation. So they start with broth, really simple, really easy to digest, and then slowly increase it to maybe things that are, you know, lightly steamed, etc. They add nut milks and flours over time. So, so it's not inundated right from the beginning. Fruit is added much later than in SCD. In SCD, they're doing fruit right from the beginning. When the person doesn't have diarrhea anymore and the foods seem to be tolerated by the person doing the thing, they're not having diarrhea, they seem to be tolerating the foods, they're not getting food allergic type reactions, then they progress to the next stage. And it really does focus on eliminating foods that they have sensitivities to. And I would superimpose on this just getting rid of all the top allergens, unless the person is really left with nothing to eat. So the gluten, the dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. The gluten and the dairy are usually eliminated at the beginning. If they can't do the GAPS intro, Dr. McBride suggests that 85% of what people eat is meat, fish, fermented dairy, and vegetables, and the fermented dairy if tolerated. So the GAPS protocols, they include the supplements plus detox and healthy lifestyle recommendations after the intro diet. So they incorporate remedies for constipation. They use drinking mineral water, that lemon mineral water in the morning, which is what a really great way, we call it the gut rejuvenator. They include vegetable juicing. And dairy is avoided for the first 4 weeks. And it's slowly introduced only if people are tolerated. And they recommend doing a skin test. I'm not sure about skin tests. I don't think those are such great ways to test for food allergies, but that's what they recommend. They start with ghee, which is clarified butter, which most of the protein has been removed, and then they move up if the person needs to add the dairy back in. Okay. So let's compare the two. The food lists are very similar. Both have an intro diet, but the GAPS intro diet is much longer and, in my opinion, much healthier because it has a lot more of the vegetables and the broths and stuff included and no dairy. Some of the foods are a little bit different. The GAPS uses bone broths, broths and fermented foods. The SCD includes broth into the diet. SCD has more food variety, so the broth can be more easily admitted. So there's more things allowed in that early stage in terms of foods that they can actually chew and eat, so you don't need to do the broths if you don't want to. Baking soda isn't allowed on GAPS, but cocoa is. Okay, so there's a few distinctions. I'm not sure the reason why the cocoa is eliminated in SCD, because I don't think of cocoa as being a high carbohydrate type food. And the GAPS uses supplements, cod liver oil and minerals and vitamins and all that, plus probiotics. So those are kind of the main differences. And again, you know, we're the kind of practitioners who are customizing things for people. So I would see that it's rare that you're going to just hand somebody one of these diets and say, here, follow this. You're going to be customizing it and making it more nutritionally dense as you can, and also customizing it for the individual person. So it's good to know them, but then the diet that you come up with for the person is going to be the Mary diet or the Sue diet or the Fred diet, because that's who you're working with. So in terms of dairy and sugars, the only dairy that's allowed on SCD are lactose-free. So the lactose has to have been broken down through the fermentation process. Hard cheeses, butter, ghee, and 24-hour fermented yogurt. There's no milk, there's no cream, there's no soft cheeses, there's no commercial yogurt. So it would have to be a homegrown yogurt. So you really knew that the lactose is being broken down to galactose. Okay, you'll always run the risk of it not being a full fermentation process. There's still being some lactose. And for the extremely lactose intolerant, that could be problematic. In terms of honey and fructose, honey is used twice a day in the Breaking the Vicious Cycle. From day one, which I think is a little bit, could be risky. GAPS introduces honey much later. Honey is high in FODMAPs and it's problematic for people with yeast. So, you know, if when in doubt, leave it out is my motto. Haas, who was the original instigator of the SCD diet, felt that fructose was the best sugar. And, you know, current research shifts and says differently, but You can easily omit the honey from the diet. That's just like an extra. But the fact is that it will allow it. So if a person's telling you they're following an SCD diet and maybe they're not getting well and maybe they still have some candida overgrowth and whatnot, it could be from the sugars that they're feeding. So bone broth. Many people don't tolerate bone broth well because it contains high amounts of amines, glutamates, which is excitatory, FODMAPs, the glycoproteins from the bones can feed SIBO, glutamates can contribute to insomnia, and the bones concentrate lead, and FODMAPs can easily cause IBS symptoms. So there's, you know, the bone broth thing has really gotten a lot of press, popular press from, you know, people doing this for healing the leaky gut, but it's not necessarily that panacea. You have to really think things through. And yes, if the person's having a little bit of the bone broth, but some of these recommendations are to have huge quantities of bone broth, like do a bone broth fast. And that could backfire in terms of leaky gut and candida overgrowth or gut dysbiosis overgrowth. So the good things about the bone broths is if it's tolerated, it can be nourishing and it has a lot of collagen in there and a lot of nutrients that can help heal the gut. You can use bone stock or meat broth instead to avoid and reduce the glycoproteins. The bone broth tolerance can be improved by using lower heat and a shorter cook time, because the longer the cook time, the more amines and glutamates that get released from the bone and can harm the person who's eating it. You can improve it by removing the skin from chicken, using an enzyme called DAO, diamine oxidase. But the problem with DAO is I haven't found a clean source of it. All of the sources contain talc and other non-desirable ingredients. And Epsom salts baths, because there can be this buildup of lead. There were a couple of studies that were done which compared bone broth with chicken broth with just vegetable broth or water. And the amount of lead was phenomenally more in the bone broth, even compared to the chicken where the meat was actually used in there. So it can be problematic for people, especially if they're prone to liver detox issues, methylation issues, where they can't detoxify the heavy metals. And of course, lead gets stored in the brain and it can affect that. So what are some of the pros of the GAPS diet? It can be low glycemic, as long as you're eliminating some of the things we talked about. It can help with chronic IBS and gut inflammation. And if the client has no serious gut issues, they can usually move fairly quickly through the intro phase. So that's good. The use of probiotics to rebalance the gut microbe is really good as well. And then the use of some of the supplements and the omega-3s and all that are definitely pros about the GAPS. The cons about the GAPS. Well, bone broths and fermented foods are high in amines, can be problematic for those with histamine issues we mentioned. Bones and cartilage broths are also high in FODMAPs and the glycoproteins that can feed SIBO. And bone broths contain glycine, which can convert to oxalates. Four of the eight GAPS intro diet veggies are high FODMAP, so people with FODMAP sensitivities or SIBO would have to be careful. Onions, garlic, leeks, and cauliflower. Then can include nuts in later stages, which have to be watched out for people with oxalate sensitivity. So these aren't necessarily across the board negative things. They're just things that you would need to be aware of for certain people. And like anything, it's not a panacea. It's not a one size fits all. And you're going to be wanting to adapt. But using the guidelines from some of these diets can really be helpful. They're higher in veggies and fruits. They can be high in salicylates for people who are sensitive there. We have another whole module on salicylates and histamines and all that. We already had an oxalate one. Fermented foods and excess probiotics can aggravate SIBO and candida. So that's something to be aware of, especially if you're not paying attention to the D-lactic acid-free probiotics. Those can feed the SIBO organisms. And then finally, the intro stages might be too low in carbs for those with mitochondrial issues. That's rare, but there are people who actually need a little bit of carb in order to feed their mitochondria. They don't go into ketone burning. So that's that. So let's look at the supplements comparison. For SCD, they will, in later stages, recommends a lactobacillus-only supplement with 3 billion. There's no FOS and there's no inulin on there. You're not allowed to, do the prebiotics, and there's no starch or sugar ingredients allowed in the supplements. With the GAPS, they don't make a distinction on the probiotics. They use cod liver oil, and they also use digestive enzymes. So let's see about differentiating between a die-off reaction and a food intolerance. A lot of people just confuse things like die-off reactions, Herxheimer reaction is what that also is called, and cleansing crises, and actually food intolerance. So with food intolerance, when you stop the food, the symptoms stop. If you don't eat it, you don't have the problem. But with the die-off reactions, they happen for a limited time span. And if you stop the foods, you're still having the reaction. So it's a limited time, usually most a few weeks, usually a few days. And usually Herxheimer or die-off reactions come in spurts. So a lot of times people will start a program and they think, oh, well, it's just a die-off reaction. And they go on and on and on, and it doesn't go away. That's more likely to be a food intolerance. So it's really a matter of doing our typical detective work, where we look at what's the person eating, how are they feeling, are there some clues, do the detective type looking at for clues. With die-off reactions, you can actually improve it with activated charcoal, because it will suck out some of the toxins, the endotoxins, from those bacteria that are dying off, that are releasing the endotoxins from their cell walls. So activated charcoal can be helpful in a case of die-off reaction. Generally doesn't help in a food intolerance reaction. You can have a food intolerance reaction that lasts for days. And so when I say the foods, when you stop eating the food, it doesn't mean immediately the symptoms go away. It means after you stop eating the foods for several days that the food gets out of the system. And then, so with die-off reactions, we have some really kind of weird symptoms, like behavioral symptoms, laughing, that happens with salicylates, teeth grinding, etc. So some specific weird reactions versus the overall malaise and achiness and sniffliness and some of the things that happen with a food sensitivity. So how do you put this into place? Well, how do you know when to put this into place? How do you know who to use this with, who to try it with, or who to try a personalized, modified version of it on? Well, when the gut and the brain are involved, like in autism and neurodegenerative type things, GAPS can be helpful, and that's how it was specifically designed. If broths and fermented foods are tolerated well and there's a need for healing, the GAPS diet can be followed, or you just add fermented foods to the SCD. I mean, they're so close food-wise, and I think what you're going to be doing is creating a custom plan for somebody based on what works and what doesn't. If there's a SIBO present, a combination of SCD and low FODMAPs can be very helpful. If you need more flexibility, the SCD diet is more flexible. There's a larger list of allowed veggies to filter out, and you have to filter out the salicylates, amines, glutamates, FODMAPs, and oxalates for people who are sensitive to those. So here's my modified SCD and FODMAP diet that I put together for helping people who have SIBO. I include SCD allowed foods, but only include SCD allowed foods. So anything that SCD eliminates, I eliminate on mine. Exclude all but the low FODMAP foods, at least initially. Exclude all processed foods, which eliminates some of the things. Exclude dried fruit and fruit juice and alcohol. Exclude caffeine with the exception of green tea and maybe a tiny bit of cocoa, but that's not allowed there. I exclude all dairy and all gluten, only organic pastured animal foods. Okay, so this is key. So I'm basically taking their diet and making it a little bit healthier. Mine is a little bit more restrictive, but there's still plenty of foods. This is a little thumbnail, I guess, of the allowed foods, and I'm going to show you. So there's the allowed foods on my modified diet, and then I have this little note. So there's a handout that you have. It's in the digestion module, and we can put it here as well. You start by using foods in the green column. Right? If they're improved after a couple of weeks, you can slowly experiment with adding desired foods from the yellow column. And if continued improvements, foods from the orange column can be added carefully. And you'll understand what this all means when I show you the charts that I put together for you. So when adding new foods, you want to monitor symptoms carefully. If they aggravate the symptoms, you remove them, just like any kind of food intolerance testing. You retest at a later date in smaller quantities to see if it was quantity related or specifically something in that food. Foods in the red column, marked with an asterisk, are recommended for permanent removal. This diet is intended for short-term use from 2 weeks to 3 months, depending on the severity of the symptom, the condition. It's far too restrictive for long-term use. So let's take a look at some of the things that are included here. As you see, I have the green column, the yellow column, the orange column, and the red column. So the stuff in the green column are allowed. They're called SCD legal, and they're low FODMAP. So this is good for right at the beginning. The moderate FODMAP are also SCD legal, but moderate FODMAP, those are the ones that you would add in slowly. And then after those are tolerated, then you can add things from the high FODMAPs. But then the red column is stuff that I think you should just be avoiding. And this goes on down here. So it's separated by vegetables, fruits, legumes and beans, nuts and seeds, dairy, eggs and meats, seasonings and condiments. Okay, so this is a much more restrictive diet, but it keeps it healthier and adds back in those foods that are higher FODMAPs after a while and keeps certain things out completely, at least during the phases of the program. And anything with an asterisk, we just leave out. Sweeteners and beverages. You can see there's not very many sweeteners and beverages. We're looking at herbal tea. I'm not a big fan of the honey. That's why I say honey only if tolerated by blood sugar. It could be great for some people, but you can't just blanketly give it. Just check to make sure they don't have blood sugar issues. If somebody has a high hemoglobin A1C and their blood sugars tend to run high, I would be avoiding the honey during this phase. And then you're adding back some of these other drinks, and there's different kinds of honeys that are mentioned in the FODMAPs as to which ones are okay and low FODMAPs and which ones are higher FODMAPs. So pay attention to that. And then the stuff that we stay away from pretty much completely is over here. Fats and oils. And that's it. So those are the foods. You can use those charts. You've got those. You've got a really nice chart with all that stuff in it on the site. You can download that. You can actually take them and you can circle things and give it to your client, or you can create your own by copy pasting the things that they can have in one column and give them a much more specific way to look at it. I liked separating it from different categories. When I first put this thing together, it was just all, here's the stuff you can eat, here's the stuff you can avoid. But I think people like having the separate pages, so I redesigned it that way. Here's some of your references, some of the people that have been doing some research on this area and have websites. And then here's some more in-depth articles that you can read about these diets. And that concludes our SCD, specific carbohydrate, and GAPS, gut and psychology syndrome diets. And thank you. And I would appreciate for you to do is to really look at the good parts of these diets and see where you can help people and see how it would fit in. And in general, like with all of our food principles and our food diets that we're looking at, is to really help pick the best of all worlds and not just use them blanketly as they are and assume that they can be good, because they can backfire and not be so good for your people.